Good morning. My name is Lou Johnson. I'm an industrial statistician with Penn State Center for Nanotechnology Utilization and Education. Today's lecture is the second in our two-part series on understanding variation and statistical process control. In today's lecture, we'll be covering the differences between normal variation and special cause variation. We'll talk about control limits and how they differ from specification limits. We'll go over the calculations for the most basic of control charts, what we call the individuals charts. We'll talk about how to create an individuals chart from your historical data, how to then go ahead and apply the 8 Nelson rules for determining out-of-control signals from that control chart. And then we'll take it one step further. We'll talk about how you can collect your data in subgroups to create an X bar and R chart. That subgroup data will allow you to create a much more powerful chart. And we'll talk about what some of the advantages of that control chart with subgroup data are. In order to illustrate these concepts, what I'll be doing is I'll be using a process that's used by Corning Incorporated to manufacture what they call Gorilla Glass. Gorilla Glass is a very ultra-thin, ultra-sensitive glass that's used in iPhones and tablets and tablet PCs and so on. So it's a very specific use glass. It's a very high-demand glass. The manufacturers of iPhones and tablets and PCs are going to demand that this glass be extremely thin, but yet extremely strong, and also it has to have very good scratch resistance in order to take all the wear and tear that a typical iPhone user or iPad user is going to impart on it. To manufacture Gorilla Glass, we'll start off with the kiln, and in the kiln, we'll go ahead and use a draw process to flow a sheet of glass, which then gets transferred to a clean room operation. In the clean room operation, we're going to handle the glass, we're going to clean the glass, and we're going to cut it into the appropriate sizes. Once we've got the glass to the appropriate size, we'll then send it to the chemical strengthening step of this process for manufacturing this glass. The chemical strengthening step uses a process called ion exchange to create a compressive strength layer on the outside of the glass, and it's this compressive layer that gives the glass its extraordinary strength and scratch resistance. The process for creating this compressive layer, or this layer in tension on the outside of the glass, is really quite straightforward. Here we see the ion exchange process, where we'll take a small piece of glass that's destined for an I6 telephone. And in that small piece of glass, we have sodium ions shown in blue here, sodium atoms shown in blue, that are a part of the glass, and the molten salt bath that we're going to immerse this material in is extremely high temperature, as you might have guessed, and it also contains free atoms of potassium, shown in yellow here. The goal is to exchange the sodium ions or sodium atoms out and bring the potassium ions in. So we're exchanging ions, sodium for potassium. And those of you who remember sodium and potassium as the alkali metals on the periodic table, potassium is much further down on the periodic table. It's a much larger ion. So what you're substituting is a much larger ion in a space where a much smaller ion used to hold that particular spot. And that squeezing in of the larger ion in a smaller space causes the compression of the glass on the outer surface where the potassium ions can get access to the sodium ions to exchange. So this exchange of potassium for sodium creates that compressive strength that we see here, and it's that compressive strength layer on both sides of the glass that gives this glass It's extremely high scratch resistance and extremely high strength, even though it still maintains a very, very thin profile, a glass profile. The way we measure that compressive layer is we pass the light through the glass. We read the light passing through what we call a polarimeter. The polarimeter here identifies the outer surface of the glass, shown in red. That outer surface of the glass has a higher compression, a higher stress level, if you will. The inner core of the glass is shown in the blue and the white and the yellow colors. This is showing the lower tension of the glass, and it's that interaction between those two that produces the strength. Now, we want to make sure that this stress is at the high enough level, and also we want to make sure that the stress is at a certain depth. So what we see here is the stress level within the glass that's going up as we go further and further into the glass, and then it begins to level off and come down as it goes towards the center of the glass. So we're going to take these stress or strain readings using the polarimeter, and we use those readings to monitor the ion exchange process to make sure that we're getting the right result, just the amount of strain that we need to get the right strength within the glass. Now, how does this all relate to process control? Let's use this ion exchange process and these strain readings to mimic your position as an engineer monitoring this process, and you're in charge of controlling this process. You're in charge of making decisions on when the process needs to be adjusted and when the process should be left alone and left to run. So here we see data for the process over time. Every 4 hours, we take a sample, we measure the strain reading on that sample, and we go ahead and plot this over time. So here we see time on the x-axis. We see the strain level measured on the y-axis, and we're monitoring our process to make sure that the strain readings are between the upper specification shown in red here and the lower specification shown in red at the lower spec. The question to you is, as the person in charge of this process, what do you do when you get a reading that's below the lower spec? You have a couple of options. You could take another measurement. You could wait for 4 hours and take the next sample. You could decide to act. I'm going to shut the process down, find out why it went down to that out-of-spec condition, and try to remedy that, try to adjust the process. Or you may not take such a drastic step. You might take a smaller step, make a minor adjustment. You need to understand the risks and benefits of each of these four options. The obvious benefit for the first two options is that you get to maintain production. Things roll along at the same production output rate because you're not stopping the process. On the other hand, you're risking that perhaps all of that production will all be out of specification and you'll be producing ware that cannot be sold to the customer. On the other hand, shutting the process down is an instant loss of production. You'll have zero production while you're making the larger process adjustments for a longer period of time. And you'll lose some production, but a smaller amount if you take a minor process, if you make a minor process adjustment. The question to you is, based on the data, based on this time series plot over time, that we use to monitor the process, what should your decision be? The most common decision that people who run the typical manufacturing operations will make is to go ahead and choose one of these two. After all, the data indicates that we are moving out of specification and something needs to be done to remedy that. On the other hand, what would you do if you had the exact same pattern of your data, but you were in specification? Does this process need to be altered because it is drifting downward toward the specification? It should become clear to you that whether you're in spec or whether you're out of spec for a tighter spec or a looser spec should be irrelevant to your decision to adjust the process. After all, if the process is starting a downward drift, even if it is in specification at this point, if it's going to continue to drift downward, you'll be out of specification at some point in time in the future, even if you have the benefit of having wider specifications than is previously seen. So a more common way we make the decision to move or adjust our process is to decide based on the specification. On the other hand, if we had an historical view of the data, if our time series plot did not begin where our recent data began, but if we could take advantage of historical data about this process, we would have a completely different outlook on what we should do in this particular situation. So the data point is the same, but our reference or our perspective is completely different if we have an historical basis upon which to make the decision to adjust the process or how we control the process. If we look at the historical data would tell us that dipping down below that lower specification is a common occurrence. Not only is it a common occurrence, it is part of the simple random normal variation that we expect from this process. And when we just let the process alone, every time it dips down below the spec, we can count on it coming right back up. After all, that is the tendency of normal random variation. What goes down must come back up if we're moving in a normal random way. So when we're faced with this data point, the question isn't, is the data point out of spec or is it in spec? The question should be, is that movement normal random variation, in which case we should just leave the process alone, it will correct itself, or is that movement something unique, something special? Is it a part of a downward trend of the data that's caused by a special change in the process? And in that situation, if it is a downward trend, regardless of whether it's in spec or out of spec, we should make some sort of process adjustment because we're going to continue to drift down. So our more enlightened decision on what to do in this scenario would ask the question, is this normal random variation or is this special cause variation? If it was normal random variation, we can count on the process just moving back up by itself, and we might choose one of these two options. Or if it's special cause variation, we would count on this drift downward as being a downward drift, and we would definitely choose one of these two options. I'll just put an S by these two, indicating that's what we'll do for special cause variation. So the question is not are we in spec or out of spec, but the question is this normal random variation or is this special cause variation? If you remember from lecture one, we have a way of identifying what the normal random variation of our process is, independent of any special cause variation. If we look at a histogram of the process, the histogram of the process identifies the center of the data, the point at which we expect most of our data points to follow. So here we see the mean level or the average level. The average level is the level of strain that we expect to incur most often. If you remember from our last lecture, about 67% of the data will fall between plus one standard deviation and minus one standard deviation. So we know where approximately 70% of our data points are expected to fall, both below the mean and above the mean. We also identify from our histogram the natural limits to our data. If we look out three standard deviations, plus 3 standard deviations and minus 3 standard deviations, what we see is that 99.7% of the data should fall between what we call the upper control limit and the lower control limit. So the histogram identifies for us the upper control limit and the lower control limit that allows us to estimate where almost all of our data would expect to remain if, in fact, there's nothing more going on here than just normal random variation. So the next step is to take the information we just learned from our histogram. We learned where our upper and lower control limits are located. We learned where the center of the data is located. We can take that information and create what we call a control chart. This is an individual's control chart. The control chart looks at your data over time. And here we have the strain data on the y-axis. And by looking at our data over time, by identifying from the histogram where the lower control limit should be located at approximately 2.1, where the upper control limit should be located at approximately 3.2, we know where the natural variation of this process is going to lead us and what data to expect within that those control limits. If we understand the control limits, then when we see this data point, we know that that data point is not beyond what we should expect from the normal variation, and then the decision to wait on more measurements that the process will write itself on its own can be made, and that's exactly what we see happens with this particular data set because there was nothing more in this data set going on other than normal random variation. So what the control chart does for you is it allows you to separate your special cause variation from your normal variation, your common cause variation. So let's go back and recap what a control chart does. A control chart is just a time series plot. You use this time series plot to monitor your process the same way you use any other time series plot. But the difference between a control chart and a typical time series plot is a control chart is modified to add the control limits that identify how much variability you should expect for any one data point over time to allow you to establish where is your normal variation so that you can distinguish that from your special cause variation. So you need to identify whether or not something special is going on in your data if you are in fact going to go ahead and make a decision as to when to make adjustments for the process or when to leave the process alone. So the unique value of a control chart is it allows us to tell our common cause variation from our special cause variation. And that is why the control chart is so valuable in its use to separate these two. The original control chart, the individual's control chart, was first developed by a process engineer in the 1920s. Walter Schuchart spent much time working in a manufacturing environment, studying processes and studying ways to control processes and identify the best ways to meet the challenge of deciding when to adjust a process and when to leave a process alone. Now, in order to understand this difference between special cause variation and common cause variation, we're going to take a much simpler process. We're going to take a process as simple as driving to work each day. Every day that you leave your home and drive to work, the amount of time it takes you to reach your destination, to reach your workplace, is either larger or smaller than it was the day before or the day before or the day it will be tomorrow or in the future because there are all sorts of sources of variation in that process of driving to work. I've listed out 9 typical sources of variation that might make the time it takes for you to get to work either be longer or be shorter. some of those sources of variation, like slow drivers in front of you or stoplights, or the mood you're in for whether you have a heavy pedal foot or not a heavy pedal foot, and so on. Some of these sources of variation happen every day. They're out of your control and are smaller, random sources of variation that we would characterize as part of the normal, natural variation of this process. On the other hand, some of these sources of variation, such as construction on your drive site, or a flat tire, or an accident, we would call special sources of variation. These special sources of variation are one-time occurrences that you do want to respond to. If you have a flat tire, you want to keep a spare in your trunk and go ahead and replace that flat tire, remedy the situation, because you need to fix that special cause in order to get the process back to its natural state. If you run into construction on your typical route to work, you're going to want to find out where that construction is going to be tomorrow, and then devise another way to get to work so that the construction, that special cause of variation, doesn't interfere with your natural process for getting into work, and you can get back to work on time. So for any process, you can list the sources of variation, and then knowing what they are, you could break them up into common cause variation or special cause variation. The difference between our drive to work process and our ion exchange process is that the ion exchange process is not only much, much more complex, so you have many, many more sources of variation, but also most of those sources of variation are going to be unknown to you. In other words, we can figure these sources of variation out for the drive time to work on our own just by understanding the process. But for most of your manufacturing scenarios, especially involving nanotechnology, the complexity of the process will not allow you to figure them out, and all you get is the voice of the process. In other words, the only clue you get for what's going on with the process is to measure the output from the process, and based on your time series plot of that output, you need to make the decision whether you think that the special cause variation is occurring that you're going to react to, or the variation that you're seeing is just the result of normal variation, which you will not react to. So on our next slide, what we see are some typical characteristics of special cause and common cause variation. So we've tried to contrast them here. So for each one, we're going to characterize special cause as being usually larger changes, whereas common cause or normal variation is going to be smaller changes. Special cause variation does not follow a normal distribution. In fact, most of the time, it will be a fast step change in your process, whereas normal variation does follow a bell curve. It is random. It can be modeled by a normal probability distribution. Special cause variation often has a single and hopefully known source of that variation. Common cause variation is usually the result of many, many small changes coming together to produce the final output data point that you measure. So in this way, there are seven characteristics of common cause variation that can be contrasted with the same characteristics for special cause variation, and this is how we tell the two apart. So this is how we can mathematically distinguish one from the other. Now, what we've listed down here in number 8 is perhaps the most important difference between the two, the reason why the control chart is such a valuable tool for anyone involved in process control, is because how you will react to that variation is different to special cause variation for common cause. If the result of the movement of your data was the result of special cause variation, your job is to find what that variation is and try to adjust the process to bring it back into the same position that it was before the cause occurred. We've already decided that if it was the result of common cause variation, you need to know that because responding to that variation, adjusting the process, will only increase the variation within your process. You're adding your own movement of the data, your own movement of the process to the normal random movement of the process, therefore widening the variation output of the process. So the most important distinguishing characteristic is number 8, is how you will react as the person in charge of the control of the process. So if we look at a control chart of a set of data here we're monitoring the copper concentration for a process. We're trying to distinguish the movements of the copper that should be responded to and what movements should not be responded to. Here we see the control chart identifies the mean or the average copper concentration. So this is the most typical value. We should expect approximately 70% of our values should fall within plus or minus one standard deviation. On the other hand, there are many data points in this particular time series plot that fall beyond what? Beyond our lower control limit and beyond our upper control limit. And by knowing where those control limits are at for this particular process, knowing where the center of the process is located, we can identify these as special cause variation that we should respond to. So in its simplest use, a control chart allows us to identify data points that are more than 3 standard deviations away from the center as unique or special cause indicators from the data from our process. Now that's the control chart used in its most basic form. Let's go ahead and add some more mathematics to our control chart. Let's take rule number 1, being beyond 3 standard deviations above or below the mean, and we're going to add some unique patterns. We're going to add 7 more for a total of 8 patterns that you won't see in the data if, in fact, there's only normal random variation going on in your process and causing the output. Now, these 8 patterns were summarized in the journal article that you should have read as your pre-reading for this lecture. They were summarized in 1984 by Lloyd Nelson. These 8 patterns that were identified in that article in the Journal of Quality Technology, you see referenced below on the bottom there, they were Schuhart's original 5 patterns that he identified in the 1920s. Those were revised again in the 1960s. The Western Electric Company incorporated those in their quality control usage within their manufacturing company. And so they expanded it out to 6 patterns. And finally, in 84, Nelson documented 8 patterns that you won't see in the data. Let's have a look at some of these patterns. Pattern number 2, test number 2, or rule number 2, as Nelson called them. They all mean the same thing. What we're looking at is that normal random data should go above the center line and should go below the center line in kind of a random fashion. Now, can we spend more time on one side of the line and less time on the other side of the line and still be random? Of course, that will occur all the time. But if, in fact, you have 9 data points, so here we have the beginning 8, and then here we have the 9th data point, then if you spend 9 data points either above the line or below the line, that's an indicator that the center of your process has shifted from the historical mean to some new mean for that particular process and a process adjustment to bring the center of the process back to its historical level is called for in this particular situation. We might look at data that trends. We're always concerned that our processes are trending or drifting either up or down. The rule number three or test number three or pattern number three identifies that if you have six data points in a row that are either all increasing or all decreasing, that that's enough data points to indicate that a pattern exists or a special cause of variation must have occurred back here to cause that trend upward in this particular scenario, in this particular output. Two additional rules of the eight that are also very commonly used are spending too much time away from the center line, but not necessarily three standard deviations away. It's common, it can occur that you can be two standard deviations away. What rule number five is going to indicate, though, is that if you have two data points out of three data points that are two standard deviations, as you see here, this is sometimes called the zone C for on a control chart. Zone C would be more than two standard deviations away from the center. That's too much time away in zone C, and that would be indicating that your process has shifted either up or down in its average output. The same can be said for being one standard deviation away. It's not uncommon to be one standard deviation above or below the mean, but to spend four out of five data points being in what we call zone B or beyond, one standard deviation or beyond, that's too much time away from the center, and that will only occur if something special happened here to cause that drop downward to here. So rule number six is a very commonly used rule. Rule number five is also a very commonly used rule in identifying special sources of variation from your data. Now, how are these rules generated? How are these patterns identified? It's really very simple. It's just a matter of probability. Back in the day, Shewhart was forced to use a normal distribution of probabilities to go ahead and calculate how rare is rare. Today, we can use process simulation to simulate those probabilities, and we don't even have to use a normal distribution to go ahead and determine these rules. So let's have a look at rule number three that identifies trending. Here we see a trend. We have a trend of 4 points in a row. Those 4 points in a row are all trending downward, downward, and downward. Now, if we simulate normal random data, what we find is that 4 points in a row heading down, that happens all the time. Normal random data can head either down or up for 4 points in a row. Very, very typically, very, very commonly, that will occur. And so we wouldn't want to identify four data points moving down as necessarily indicative of something unusual going on in the process. Now, on the other hand, normal random variation will cause the fifth data point in this trend to go down in a much, much lower level than the four data points in a row. So it's not as common as four data points, but still Shewhart determined that it was not rare enough to stop at 5 points. In other words, he calculated the probability that you would be beyond three standard deviations away from the center. We know what that probability is. That probability is approximately 1/3 of 1%. So what Shewhart did was he set rule number one as the standard for how unlikely does a pattern have to be before it indicates a trend? And what he calculated is that the sixth data point will reach this probability level, and therefore we set test number three to be six data points in a row trending up or trending down is indicative of something special happening six or seven data points earlier in the process. In this way, we can calculate which patterns are only likely to occur 1/3 of 1% of the time under normal random variation, and that's how we determine each of the eight rules. Now, when we're applying these eight rules, we have the benefit of something that Shewhart did not have the benefit of. We have a computer available today and software such as Minitab software that's shown here that will allow us to detect the patterns in the data using the computer rather than having to manually count data points and see whether we're violating any of these eight rules or not. The most common violation of normal random variation is going to be rule number one, where we have one data point more than three standard deviations away from the center line. We already discussed rule number three that says it takes six data points in a row, either increasing or decreasing, to identify a trend. And as I mentioned, two of the more common rules that are paired with rule number one and rule number three are rule number five, that says 4 out of 5 data points more than 2 standard deviations away from the center line is enough to indicate a special source of variation, or rule number 6 that says 4 out of 5 data points more than 1 standard deviation away from the center line are enough to indicate a special source of variation. Now, different manufacturing processes and different companies use different combinations of these eight rules. Some companies use just rule number one because they consider rule number one the strongest indicator of special cause variation, and it simplifies their process for interpreting the control charts. Oftentimes, other companies will then add rule number three because we're always worried about trends. Also, we'll add to that rules number 5 and 6, because as we see, 5 and 6 only require either 3 or 5 data points to determine that you're out of control. If you figure out that you're out of control 15 data points further down your process from where the variation occurred or the special cause occurred, you're not as likely to figure out what that special cause was or be in a position to go ahead and remedy that. So some companies use those four rules. Other companies just use all eight. If we use all eight rules, then we go ahead and we create a control chart that's the most sensitive to special causes of variation, that allows us to have the highest chance of identifying when something unique is going on in our process. So if we go back to our copper data, what we see is if we implement all eight tests, rather than just using the rule number one, we identify certain clusters of data that indicate times when we were out of control, certain data points when we were out of control for violating one of the additional 7 rules for special cause variation. And in fact, if we go back to our ion exchange data for the ion data, strain data for the ion exchange process, we'll see that when in fact we did not violate any times going beyond the lower control limit and the upper control limit, we did have a special cause variation that caused us to spend too much time below the center line, violating rule number 5, or too much time above the center line, violating rule number 6. So the addition of the 7 more Nelson rules allows us to create a control chart with greater power, or greater sensitivity to to detect special cause variation. Now let's take this concept of a control chart to separate common cause variation from special cause variation. Let's take that one step further. So we started with the original control chart, then we added to it seven more rules or patterns, identification patterns for identifying special cause variation that made it more powerful. We're going to take the next step and identify another technique for making your control chart even more powerful. The process we're going to use to illustrate the idea of a subgrouped control chart is your typical dry etching process that we use to etch circuitry on silicone wafers to create microprocessors or semiconductors that are commonly used in modern electronics. Now, the etching of this process, if it was going to take place as we would like it to take place, would take place in an anisotropic fashion for that etching. When you have an anisotropic process, what will happen is the mask that prevents etching of the silicone metal substrate shown below here will be perfect. So the only part of the substrate that gets etched is the part of the substrate that the mask is allowing the etching process to occur. This is a perfect scenario. A more typical scenario is an isotropic etch where we mask out a certain area, but the area that gets substrate that gets etched ends up extending beyond, giving us a wider width or a more narrow width than we might have hoped for. So the way we measure the quality of our etching process is to go ahead and measure what we call the aspect ratio of the grooves that we manufacture. The aspect ratio is simply the depth of the etch divided by the width of the etch. With a perfect aspect ratio of 1, meaning we've got our anisotropic etching going on, and the further away from 1 we're getting, the lower the quality of the etching process. So what we're going to do is we're going to use this etching process. We're going to measure the aspect ratio of our wafers over time to monitor the process to make sure that our dry etch process is doing what it's supposed to be doing. However, in this case, we're going to collect our data in what we call subgroups. Subgroup data is collected where at a certain period of time, here at 8 o'clock, we're going to collect not one sample, but a number of samples, in this case, 5. And those 5 samples represent our process, a snapshot of that process at 8 o'clock in the morning. So they represent our process at 8 o'clock in the morning. We'll take those 5 readings. We'll estimate, we'll calculate the mean of those 5 readings to estimate the center of that process. We'll calculate the range of those 5 readings to estimate the variability within that process, and then we'll use those 5 readings as our snapshot estimate of where the center of our bell curve is located by the mean, and then the width of the bell curve as indicated by the range of the data. Once we've taken that snapshot and calculated the mean and the range, we'll go ahead and wait for 4 hours. At 12 o'clock, we'll take another 5 samples, another subgroup, subgroup number 2, and we'll once again calculate the mean and the range. We'll plot these mean values on what we call the X-bar chart. We call it the X-bar chart because in statistics, whenever I put a bar over anything, it means to calculate the average of whatever I put the bar over. So X bar implies that we're calculating the mean of our X's, and then the range is an indicator of the spread of the bell curve. We're going to plot our ranges on a range chart to monitor the variability in the process. So what we're going to do is we're going to apply the exact same concepts that we applied to a standard individual's control chart, only now we're going to be control charting the mean of our data and the range of our data on two separate control charts, and we'll present those control charts side by side so we can monitor the variability and the center of our process at the same time, at the same points in time. Here, if we look at the X-bar chart, the X-bar chart is shown up top. The X-bar chart establishes control limits for the mean of our process. Those control limits for the mean of the process will be much tighter than the control limits for the individual data points for our process, and we'll describe why that is in the next slide. And then we interpret these data points in exactly the same way as we interpret an individual's chart. Here, the average or the mean of our data towards this subgroup and this subgroup indicate that we violated rule number one, being beyond our three standard deviation control limits. Here, we violated test number five for this subgroup, and we violated test number six for this subgroup by spending too much time either above or below the center line identified by the average of our averages. So the X-bar chart identifies when we are going out of control for the center of the process. And then the range chart shown here, here's our range chart shown below, identifies when the variability of our process is gone beyond its typical variability. Now, the range chart is a little bit different than the X-bar chart. The range chart can only have a lower control limit of zero. The range of your data, of course, can never be any lower than zero, but it's more the upper control limit, here shown to be about 0.15 for this particular set of data, that identifies when the variability in our process is so large that it's beyond the typical, what we would expect from typical normal random variation. So here we're going to use the X-bar and R chart for subgroup data to identify, again, special cause sources of variation occurring in our process. The output from Minitab that's used to create these control charts will identify for each specific test which subgroups violated which test, and it will also again reiterate what the test was, test number one being three standard deviations above or below the center line. And the same gets done for the ranges on the R chart. So being able to identify which subgroups are which allows you to go back to that point in time and try to identify what occurred to cause that change. Now, why do we recommend the X-bar and R chart over the individual chart? There are three clear and important differences between the X-bar chart, or important advantages, I might say, between the X-bar chart and the R chart and the individual's chart. The first, and I would say perhaps the most important, is that the X-bar chart paints a much clearer picture of the movement of the center of your data than the individual data points do. When I look at the individual data points, the movement of the individual data points will be dictated by whatever the standard deviation of the individual data points is for that particular process output. So you're going to be forced to try to discern the movement of your process data points from common cause, which is the standard deviation, to special cause, which is something beyond the normal standard deviation, by looking at a larger number, the standard deviation of the individual data points. The average chart, or the X-bar chart, does not, the movement of the data is not dictated by the standard deviation of the data points. It's dictated by the standard deviation of those averages. The standard deviation of the averages will always be a fraction of the standard deviation of the individuals. That's dictated by whatever sample size you use. So in this case, when we have a sample size, of 5, the variation of the averages will be the square root of a 5, or approximately half as much as the standard deviation of the individual data points. This lower variation provides a much clearer picture of the data and of your process, and allows you to identify what's going on in your process much more clearly. The second benefit is that the averages, or the means that you're plotting, will always follow a normal distribution. The central limit theorem dictates that whenever you have the average of several data points, those averages will always follow a normal distribution, even if the individual readings follow nothing even close to a normal distribution. So one of the assumptions that Shewhart had to make was Shewhart had to assume that the data he was collecting followed a bell curve. When you use the X-bar chart, you don't have to make that assumption. The averages have to follow a bell curve. The central limit theorem is a simple theorem within statistics that says that the averages will always follow a normal distribution. Finally, the very, very practical difference between the individuals and the X-bar and R is that the X-bar and R allow you to track the center of the data and the variation of the data at the same time. And of course, when we look at a bell curve, there are only two important characteristics of a bell curve: where is its center and how wide is it? So the X-bar and R chart allows you to monitor both of those very important characteristics of your process. Now, does that mean you should never use an individual's chart? Does that mean you should never use the eye chart? No, nothing could be further from the truth. There's many times where you're forced to use the eye chart, and it's the best solution to your process control problem that you can come up with. So you're going to use an individual's chart when you have a single continuous process and a particularly expensive or difficult measurement. So there are many times where you're only going to get one data point from your process, and the best you can do with that data point is to monitor your process with an individual's chart. I will mention, however, that the individual's chart works best if the variability of those individual data points is very, very low. So it'll work best when you have low variation, not that you can't create an individual's chart when you have high measurement variation, but the control limits on your process will be so wide that everything will look like it's in control, and it won't be a very sensitive chart. Also, let's try to remember, Shewhart assumed your data needed to be normally distributed when he created the control charts. You don't have to worry about that assumption for the X-bar chart, you do for the eye chart. So there are certain times when the eye chart is practical, and you should use it, but you should try to go for the subgroup data. Subgroup charts are a more powerful route to go. Now, there is an alternative to the R chart. You could calculate the standard deviation of your 5 data points just as easily as you can calculate the range of your 5 data points, and you can therefore create, we'll call an X-bar and S chart instead of the X-bar and R chart. The reason why the X-bar and S chart is not that popular is because historically, in Shewhart's time, he had no calculator or computer available to him to calculate S, so he was forced to use R as a calculation that he could do with paper and pencil and monitor relatively easily. With today's modern computer software, we're going to go ahead and choose the S chart over the R chart. In certain scenarios, it'll be beneficial to you. So they provide the same function, but you can use the S chart in certain scenarios and get a benefit from using the S chart over the R chart. The downside to the S chart is you have to have a calculator or a computer. You can't do it by hand. It will perform pretty similar to the R chart for small sample sizes. Now, a subgroup size of 5 is kind of arbitrary, so this general idea that these two are equivalent is true for smaller subgroup size, but we usually draw 5 as the limit where the R chart and the S chart will start to diverge in their performance. On the other hand, if your subgroup size gets up to 9 or larger, you almost have to use the S chart. R has the characteristic to it that the larger the subgroup size, the larger the range is going to be. So as the subgroup size goes up, the range of your data will go up. The probability that you'll get a high or a low value, and therefore a high range, increases as the number of samples you sample goes up. So R ends up being a function of the subgroup size, whereas S is not. S is completely independent of the subgroup size. So you should use the S chart when you have a large subgroup size. You should also use the S chart when you have an unequal subgroup size. Those unequal subgroup sizes will dictate that you cannot graph the R for a subgroup size of 5 next to the R for a subgroup size of 12 and expect them to be the same value. The range for a subgroup size of 12 will almost have to be larger than that. So if you have unequal subgroup sizes, you'll go ahead and use the X bar and S chart. So let's recap what we've learned. We've learned that modern nanotechnology processes demand accurate control plans. That accurate control plan requires that you cannot use your gut instinct. You cannot use an emotional response to the data. An emotional response being, am I in specification or am I not in specification, to make the decision as to whether or not you need to adjust the process. Modern processes involving nanotechnology require control charts with control limits that identify the normal variation of the process as in order to distinguish it from the special cause variation of the process. Over the years, statisticians have identified 8 commonly used rules or patterns in the data that you won't see unless something special caused them. We use modern software to identify these patterns by using these 8 rules to identify special cause variation. Your monitoring of the process can do an excellent job of identifying when control or adjustment of the process is warranted, and also identifying when it's not warranted and leaving the process alone is actually the better response to the movement of the data. If your process data is collected in subgroups, you can go ahead and analyze that data using control charts for subgroup data. This will give you a more sensitive control chart, what we call a more powerful control chart than the standard individual's control chart. That's it for SPC and process variation. I thank you for your time.